Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The United States locks up people at a higher rate than any other country. 2.3 million people are currently behind bars. On today's Media Roundtable, we are talking about how the media cover and shape public opinion about the prison system. How do terms like tough on crime and harsh sentencing affect coverage? Today, we are joined by Maurice Shama, a staff writer at the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system. One of Maurice's latest pieces, 7 years behind bars for two joints, and now he's free. Bernard Noble, whose case became a symbol of harsh drug laws, walks out of a Louisiana prison. And that piece was written on April 12th. And Maurice Shama joins us from New York. Hi, Maurice. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Victoria Law, a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration. Her latest piece for In These Times, corporations are profiting from immigrant detainees' labor. Some say it's slavery. Victoria Law is the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, and she's co-author of the forthcoming book, Your Home is Your Prison. And Victoria joins us from New York. Hi, Victoria. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you.
Thanks for covering this.
Well, thank you for all your great reporting you've done. We're also joined by Susana Ferreira. She's a Portuguese-Canadian freelance journalist who has reported for a number of publications around the globe. Her reporting focuses on development and aid, drug policy, and the politics of migration. Susana wrote a lengthy Guardian story about the decriminalization of drugs back in 2001. And since then, she reports that Portugal has seen dramatic drops in overdoses, HIV infection, and drug-related crimes. So why hasn't the world copied it? Susana joins us from Madrid, Spain. Hi, Susana. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So Maurice Shama with the Marshall Project, what caught your attention this week?
Certainly, the thing that everyone I know in criminal justice work was talking about was the second part of a two-part article by a magazine writer named Pamela Koloff. She's from Texas, and this was a piece for a kind of joint job she has between ProPublica, a nonprofit, and the New York Times Magazine. It was about the case of a guy named Joe Bryan in a small town in East Texas who had gone to prison many years ago for the murder of his wife. He was the principal of the local high school. They were a couple known around town, and everyone was sort of stunned when it turned out that he was convicted in a trial of killing her and sent to prison for it. But there were always a lot of questions hanging over the case as to why he would have done it and whether the conviction was really so solid after all. And it turns out that a lot of that conviction turns on the interpretation of blood stains. And so Koloff, the writer, goes deep into this one case, but then also gives the much broader context of how different types of forensic sciences have been attacked over the last decade as being, unscientific. And blood stain pattern analysis is sort of the latest one that's being examined. And for that article, she spent a week taking a 40-hour blood stain analysis class that was akin to the class that the man who testified at this man's original trial had taken. And so she was able to kind of report in a first-person way about that experience, in addition to giving this really rich history of how we understand the science that sends people to prison. It was a really fantastic article.
It's called Blood Will Tell by Pamela Koloff, and she reports Joe Bryan has spent the past 3 decades in prison for the murder of his wife, a crime he claims he did not commit. His conviction rested largely on bloodstain pattern analysis. Wow, this is a very lengthy story.
Very lengthy.
Incredible reporting here. Thank you for this, Maurice. We will definitely put a link to this piece right after the show. That is Maurice Shama, staff writer with the Marshall Project. What about you, Victoria Law? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I always am drawn to stories of people who are most impacted by policies and laws who are actually fighting back to change them. So what caught my eye this week was a piece on theappeal.org, which is formerly known as Injustice Today, by Melissa Gira Grant, called The New Orleans Police Raid That Launched a Dancer Resistance. And it follows the story of what happened after 8 clubs on Bourbon Street in New Orleans were raided in January, supposedly as a quote-unquote first step to confront human trafficking, as was said by the New Orleans Police Department. And it closed these clubs, and no trafficking charges were ever filed against anyone, and it put hundreds, if not thousands, of dancers out of work. And for listeners who may not be aware, dancing at a strip club in New Orleans is much better paying than, say, being a bartender or, you know, working in food service or being a wait staff. And instead of just quietly putting up with this, the dancers organized themselves into BEAR, or the Bourbon Alliance of Responsible Entertainers, and they began organizing. They held protests, they held marches, they flocked to the city council, and they actually got the city council not to vote yes on a proposal to limit the number of clubs on Bourbon Street to 1 club per block, noting that this was going to impact their livelihood, impact their ability to support themselves and their families. And basically their demand was, you know, leave us alone. Basically, let us be able to do our jobs. Stop doing this. And it really inspired me to look at the coverage of not just these raids and its effects on the people who were dancing at these clubs, but also the ways in which they organized to fight back despite all of these other things that are going on in their lives.
Wow, that sounds like another fascinating story. Did you say this was Injustice Today?
It's now called The Appeal.
Okay.
But it was formerly known as of last week as Injustice Today.
Okay.
So if people know about Injustice Today, they can find the story, or they can go to theappeal.org.
Okay, because I just searched for it, and it went to The Appeal, which is something I've never heard of, but this sounds like a fascinating website. Their top story is these public defenders want to fight bias from the bench. Lots of really good stories on this issue. So thank you for that one. That is Victoria Law. She's a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration. And what about you, Susanna? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm fuzzing the rules a little bit because this didn't come out last week, but there's a podcast, it's a partnership between Long Reads and Oregon Public Broadcasting called Bundyville that I've never sat and taken in an entire multi-part series like that at once before, but I found the reporting just so rich and so gripping. It follows the story of, without revealing too much, it follows the story of the Bundy family in Nevada and some of the armed uprisings that they've been a part of in Nevada and in Oregon. And it's very much a case in because it is a podcast, you do follow the reporter as they go along, and radio can be very intimate. You get a sense of just how challenging it can be to report on a faith group, on a political group, on a cultural group that you may be carrying biases against, and the work that you really have to do to open up and report honestly and fairly and have those difficult conversations. I was quite impressed with it.
And this got so much attention when this standoff was happening. What would you say is different about this reporting?
For one, you go right into people's homes, and you do ask a lot of questions are laid out. There are more questions than answers, I would say. And that to me is more interesting, in that you're invited as a listener and as just an engaged human being to ask some of those questions of yourself and examine some of your own biases as well, and wonder how do we get to these points? Because that's one example, but there are a lot of occasions where we have to stop and ask ourselves, how did we get here?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, we've been doing a week-long series on the prison system in the U.S., and that's the same question we have been asking. How did we get here? Well, this sounds like a great also podcast, Bundyville, a series from Long Reads in partnership with the Oregon Public Broadcasting. And we'll put a link there right after the show. That is Susana Ferreira. She's a Portuguese-Canadian freelance journalist who has reported for a number of publications. And Susana, we wanted to bring you on because every time I read about the decriminalization of drugs in Portugal, it's kind of mind-blowing, given that about 48% of the 2.3 million people behind bars here in the United States are in for drug charges. And I've been wanting to do a show about Portugal for a long time. In 2001, Portugal became the first country in the world to decriminalize the possession and consumption of illicit substances. And so rather than be arrested, if you're caught with drugs, you might get a warning, a small fine, or you're told to appear before a local commissioner, a doctor, a lawyer, a social worker, to deal with treatment and harm reduction. And you do such an amazing job in your Guardian piece. It's very lengthy, talking to doctors, talking to so many people affected by this. Before we dive in and talk about the reporting, what led to such a radical shift in drug policy in Portugal in 2001?
Well, there was a radical shift in culture. I get into this a little bit in the article, but and there is a longer, the Guardian version is lengthy, but there's an even lengthier version that came out in the Common that was later adapted for the Guardian. And I get into it a little bit more there in that the 70s were this period of tremendous upheaval in the country. There had been a dictatorship, the regime fell, there was a brief period of communism and then democracy. There was just a massive series of shifts, and when the regime fell, the country also opened up. It had been very isolated beforehand. So more substances started to come in, and that because there had been no real previous contact with illicit substances, substances apart from tobacco and alcohol, people were quite caught off guard by heroin. Didn't really know what they were getting into until it was kind of too late, and it spread pretty far and was in the north, was in the south, was in the islands, was in rich people's homes, was in government, was in universities and schools, was in mining communities, farming communities a little bit less. Fishing communities, coastal communities were quite heavily hit. And because it was, as they say in Portugal, it was quite transversal, it threatened the very fabric of the country. It got into everyone's household somehow, whether it was someone who lived there or it was a neighbor or someone. It was hard at the time, a lot of people say, to find someone who wasn't affected somehow by problematic drug use. And I'm not sure I do a very good job in the piece, but there is a difference between addiction and dependency. And it was this, it was addiction, but more than, I'm losing my train of thought just a little bit. But because there was so much, the drug use was so problematic and it was so destructive, people's behavior became destructive, their households started to fall apart, families started to fall apart, relationships started to fall apart, people wouldn't show up for work or their small businesses would fold because they couldn't keep it together. So it was that sort of thing. It touched absolutely every sector you can think of in a community and in a country.
Wow. It made
Portugal's not that big.
And it makes me think, when I was reading your story about the effects, it made me think about the opioid crisis here in the United States. You report that Portugal has seen dramatic drops in overdoses and drug-related crimes. What else strikes you about the changes that Portugal has seen since drugs have been decriminalized?
The prison population has gone down. Mm. There was a very large proportion. I can't recall the exact proportion, but it was a pretty large percentage of people who are incarcerated were there on possession charges. So that has improved. You were speaking about language in the introduction to this program, and the change in language was very important here. Rather than referring to people as junkies or as addicts or using other sort of derogatory language, people were referred to with more scientific terms, and that became more commonly used. People didn't want to refer to their loved ones in those ways either. They had to make a choice of whether, do you really want to demonize what they're doing, or do you want to love the person and figure out a way to keep them in your lives and keep them healthy. The way people thought about drugs changed very much. So you're not, there is a system in place for harm reduction and an interconnected series of state-run or state-sponsored agencies that will help people with dependencies and addictions. But no one is trying to get people to stop using drugs necessarily. They want them to stop harming themselves and their communities, and they want them to find some way that they themselves can live healthy lives. So there isn't this thing of drugs equal bad and we have to get rid of all of them. It's this thing of, all right, this exists. This is something that we have to live with. What is the best way for us to live with that? So just that shift in mentality, that choice of what is important to us. What's important to us is healthy people and healthy loved ones and healthy communities. Okay, how do we get there? And that was the thing that struck me the most.
Susanna Ferreira is a freelance journalist who has written about the decriminalization of drugs in Portugal in 2001. We're also joined today by Victoria Law, a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration, and Maurice Chama, a staff writer at the Marshall Project. He covers the criminal justice system. Maurice, when you hear about the massive changes that we've seen in Portugal, what goes through your mind? I mean, especially when I think about all of the reporting you've done on drug crimes, specifically the piece you wrote just last month about Bernard Noble, whose case became a symbol of harsh drug laws. He spent 7 years behind bars for two joints.
Mm-hmm. He did. That was in Louisiana, and that was a case that advocates for, you know, lesser or more lenient drug sentences in the U.S. Really held up as symbolic of just how kind of, you know, extreme and out of control the kind of barometer has gotten in the U.S. in terms of what people think is normal. I also did a story recently about how in Kansas, people who have been convicted of drug crimes are often forced to register on a public registry that's sort of akin to what most people think of as being like the sex offender registry, right, where your name and your face and your address are all published online, and anyone who's in your neighborhood or a potential employer, et cetera, can look you up. And it makes it very, very hard for these people who have a drug conviction in their past to move on from their in their life and find a job and housing, et cetera. We published something else a couple weeks ago about a man who was so fed up with the ways in which those restrictions affected his life that he just picked up and moved to Alaska, where no one would ask questions about his past or look him up on the internet. And so it speaks to a kind of cultural punitiveness that is has a really kind of long-standing strain in American life. But I'd also say that we're in a moment right now where there's a lot of conversation and upheaval in the way that people think about these questions, and I think sort of more than was true even 5 or 10 years ago. Susanna's right that, you know, there's the way they do things in Portugal has not caught on here in the U.S., but slowly you're starting to see just little, you know, fragments of rethinking. Different state legislatures are looking at mandatory minimums, and you're seeing, like Victoria said, kind of community groups fighting back and finding some success in that regard. I also want to bring up in this context, a few years ago we covered a trip in which a group of people who run prisons in the U.S. traveled to Germany and visited prisons there, the idea being that they would bring back good ideas to the United States. And now, several years later, we're starting to see some of those experiments, come to life. And so, for example, in Connecticut, they are bringing young prisoners together in a prison unit together and giving them intensive mentorship from older prisoners and sort of just overwhelming them really with therapeutic and new innovative ways of helping them and trying to create a situation where they feel like they can come back into the world after their prison sentence and be successful and not just fall back into the patterns of life that got them into prison in the first place. So you do see, I see sort of looking around the country, little encouraging signs that people are sort of rethinking things. Sometimes they're looking to Europe, sometimes they're just looking internally, but I think we're in a kind of a moment of upheaval and rethinking on these issues.
Victoria, what would you add? And just to add a few facts in, according to the Drug Policy Analysis Alliance, the number of arrests in 2016 for drug law violations, 1.5 million. Number of people arrested for marijuana law violations, 653,000. And the majority were Black or Latino, even though they use drugs at similar rates as whites. So, Victoria, what would you add just in terms of how specifically drug offenses and the drug war is covered in the U.S.?
Well, I think that one of the things that we're seeing, as Maurice pointed out, is that we're seeing gradual shifts in thinking about drugs and drug offenses. But what we're also seeing is that police are still arresting people for drug offenses. They're still disproportionately targeting Black and brown people, given the numbers that you just gave us, 1.5 million arrests for drug offenses, 653,000 arrests for marijuana violations alone, despite growing change in policies or supposed changes in policies where prosecutors are telling police not to go after people for possession of marijuana. So what we're seeing is that these arrests are still happening. And what we're also seeing is that the media coverage is often about the prosecutor's announcement, like in Manhattan and in Brooklyn, that they're telling their police and their assistant district attorneys not to go after people for marijuana violations. But we're not seeing coverage about how these proclamations aren't necessarily being carried out on the ground, and we're still seeing a lot of people getting swept up into the net of criminalization despite this. And what we're also not seeing are all of the other sort of collateral consequences of the focus on drugs, the focus on drugs exclusively or almost exclusively. One of the things that I did want to point out is that even if drugs were totally decriminalized tomorrow, it wouldn't necessarily mean that people who are currently inside prisons would all be let out en masse. There are still so many people locked up for other crimes or convictions that may be tangentially related to drugs, as in they might not have done what they did, like a robbery or an assault or something else, had they not been on drugs or had drugs not been criminalized. But at the same time, they don't fall under the more sympathetic category of nonviolent drug offenders. Mm.
And Susanna, before we go, as someone who covers issues around the globe and who has written extensively about the decriminalization of drugs in 2001, what strikes you most about the reporting that you read? And obviously you're listening to that Bundy podcast, so you pay close attention. What strikes you most about how reporting on prisons is done in the United States?
Reporting on prisons in the U.S.? Goodness. Honestly, as I was listening to that, I was thinking of, very quickly, I have to mention this. I'm also Canadian. Canada is about to legalize cannabis this year. And there's still no plan in place for amnesties or to have people's records expunged. And it's some 600,000 people in Canada with criminal records for cannabis possession. And the vast majority are the people who are targeted are Black and Indigenous people, and the people who are incarcerated in Canada on drug offenses are by and large Black and especially Indigenous people. That's something that's been on my mind quite a lot in the last few months in the lead up to that. But as for how prisons are covered in the U.S., as an outsider, this is a funny question for me to answer. Because just the size of the incarcerated population is still a bit boggling for me to wrap my mind around, if I can be quite honest. The language that's used with incarcerated populations, just as the language that's used with people who use drugs is often very damning and reveals a lot about what kind of biases a writer is carrying or whoever is speaking is carrying. Language matters quite a lot. Mm. And that's a very vague answer, but...
No, I just think it is so interesting. I mean, your perspective looking in at a country that locks up 2.3 million people a year, and there's a lot of money to be made from this industry. Susanna, we would love to have you back to spend the entire hour on what happened in Portugal. And I think the question that you raise in your piece is very important in The Guardian. Why hasn't the world copied this? Susanna, thank you for your reporting, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Susanna Ferreira is a Portuguese-Canadian journalist who has extensively written about the decriminalization of drugs in 2001 in Portugal. She writes that since that happened, there have been dramatic drops in overdoses, drug-related crimes, and the prison population has decreased. You can find her story at yourcallradio.org. After the break, we'll continue talking about how the media shape public opinion about prisons with Victoria Law, a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration, and Maurice Shema, a staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
From the dead, Ukraine stages the murder of a Russian dissident journalist to foil a real assassination plot. New York welcomes a top advisor from North Korea for secret talks about talks. And a real-life Spider-Man in France changes the debate over European migrants. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
1A coming up in about half an hour at 11 a.m. here on KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling now, 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255, and you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. And on today's roundtable, we are talking about how the media cover and shape public opinion about the prison system. The U.S. locks up people at a higher rate than any other country. 2.3 million people are currently behind bars. While the number of men is actually decreasing, the number of women in prison is increasing. And today we're joined by Maurice Shema, a staff writer at the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. Victoria Law is a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration. She's the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. I wanted to ask you both about what Susanna said before the break about language. In her story, she says that those who had been referred to as junkies became known more broadly and more sympathetically and more accurately as people who use drugs or people with addiction disorders. Victoria, what did you think about what Susanna said about the importance of language in reporting?
I think it makes a huge difference in allowing readers to visualize people who are behind bars as more than just scary, faceless people who are in prison. I remember a few years ago speaking with an advocate from Release Aging People in Prison who talked about the importance of language in reaching people who might think that people who committed murder or assault or armed robbery, who had been sentenced to decades in prison and now were older, over age 50, 60, 70, and were not in the best of health and were really trying to come home but kept getting hit or denied at the parole board because of the nature of their crime. I remember him saying they started using the term aging people rather than lifers. So they started using the term elderly people instead of saying people sentenced to life or people with, or long-termers or terms that set them in prison as opposed to terms that emphasize that they were also people who happened to be in prison. And oftentimes it changed the way that people were responding to the conversation so that when they visited senior citizen centers and talked about laws that would allow aging people to appear before the parole board and not have the parole board automatically deny them based on the nature of their crime, their audience was more receptive to listening to them talk about why people who are in their 70s should not be held in prison forever for something that they did, no matter how harmful and violent, in the 1970s when they were much younger and much different people.
Mm-hmm. Maurice, what would you add?
So I would add that I've noticed, I think, over the years, the past maybe, I don't know, 5 years, more awareness about just those really tiny specific words, like whether you call someone a felon or an inmate. When you go report an actual prison, you find often that the people working in the prison refer to them as offenders. And I've noticed that there's a sort of ongoing and really robust debate, at least in the Marshall Project where I work, about what words you use. And in certain advocacy circles, there might be a really kind of long, clunky phrase like justice-involved individuals or something, which is might be emphasize their peopleness in a way, but then also if you imagine having that phrase multiple times in a paragraph, it can get sort of weighed down. I also think that in addition to language, there's been a sort of slow and ongoing shift around the narratives that, you know, journalists kind of tuck in when they contextualize who a person is. So, for example, you know, you might see there's a big difference in an article saying so-and-so who killed their husband versus saying so-and-so who was a victim of domestic abuse and then, mm-hmm. I think that shift is part of a larger kind of cultural reckoning with sort of the vulnerabilities and frailties that people have and how they end up in prison, the sort of backstories of why people, do the things that they do that lead them to prison. One group that's kind of unlikely that has emerged in my work that I think is sort of worth bringing up here is people who... So I report a lot on the death penalty, and in death penalty cases, if you're potentially going to be sentenced to death, you're guaranteed a lawyer, and often you get a really top-notch lawyer in a lot of these cases. And that lawyer will hire a mitigation investigator, and this is somebody who goes out and learns everything about your life, basically becomes your biographer. And the goal is to show a jury, yes, this person did something that we consider really terrible, but also their life circumstances were really complex, and they're human, and there might be things about their life that once you knew them would make you think, oh, that person really doesn't deserve to die. They don't deserve the harshest possible punishment. And I don't think necessarily that, you know, it's easy to imagine a system in which everybody, you know, arrested for marijuana possession all the way up to every rape and robbery and assault is going to get that huge, robust investigation of their life circumstances. Mm-hmm. But you're starting to see in certain cases, lawyers, family members are saying...
Maurice?
Oh, yes.
Are you still there? We're having some problems with your line.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
All right. The point I was making was just that even though the kind of robust life history that you're seeing in death penalty cases might not be practical to apply in every single case in the criminal justice system, you are starting to see a movement of family members of people who might be incarcerated or conscientious public defenders or even, you know, just sort of thoughtful journalists saying, let's really like look at the sort of broader life context for how this person ended up committing this crime or their undiagnosed mental illnesses or traumatic brain injuries or histories of abuse and neglect and poverty that shaped the way in which this person found themselves committing a crime, and even if it's a crime that we consider, you know, scary and not, you know, not a person that we want out on the street, there's opportunities for sympathy that I think we're seeing start to sort of open up.
Do you agree with that, Victoria?
Yes, I definitely do. I think that telling that narrative and giving that context, so again, they're not this cardboard cutout of a scary person who is summarized in one sentence as the worst thing that they have ever done or the worst thing that they've been arrested for, but also looking at the narrative and the circumstances. I cover a lot of the intersections between domestic violence and criminalization. So on the face of a prosecution, it might look like woman hits man with car, man dies. Woman is arrested for first-degree murder. And when you actually look more into the story, so say the case of Sherelle Baldwin, who was a Connecticut black woman and mother who had broken up with her abusive ex-boyfriend. They had a child together, so he was not totally out of her life. He continued to harass her, be violent towards her, send her threatening text messages, and then one night to morning, so late at night to early morning, he sent her something like 72 text messages, which became increasingly threatening and saying things like, if I can't have you, nobody can have you. You know, you think you can get rid of me. And then he broke into her house and tried to strangle her at 5 a.m. when she was sleeping in the bed next to their baby. And she managed to escape, ran out to her car, got in the car, realized, like, he chased after her. She realized she had forgotten the baby in her hurry, started the car, somehow hit him, and also ended up under the car. I don't drive. I don't know anything about how cars work and how this is all possible, but she ended up with a broken leg. He ended up going to the hospital where he died, and the initial newspaper accounts were angry ex-girlfriend runs over boyfriend, kills him, wow, arrested for murder, and didn't look at this backstory of how she had met this man, they had gotten together, he had been controlling, he didn't want her to see their family, they had a baby together. When they finally broke up, he continued to be controlling and abusive and used their shared son to continue his abuse and his control until it finally escalated to the point in which he broke in, tried to kill her, and had she not run out of the house, we might very well just be seeing an obituary that says, man breaks into house, kills ex-girlfriend, the end. If you look at just the one sentence of what is she being prosecuted for, the prosecution is for first-degree murder. Wow. She spent 3 years in Connecticut. The jails and prisons are together. So she spent 3 years in the women's prison in Connecticut because bail was set at $1 million, which her family could not afford. She went to trial about a year and a half after her arrest, and 11 jurors voted to acquit. One person held out for a conviction. A mistrial was declared. She went back to prison, waited another year and a half, went to trial again, and this time the jury got to hear the full story. You know, like, and all of the jurors understood that really, had she not tried to escape, she very well could be dead, and he would be sitting there also accused of murder. And she was acquitted, and she finally, 3 years later, got to go home, wow, to her family.
I mean, that's amazing. In that case, what we need is a journalist to take the initiative to learn more about this woman and then spend the time that's required to actually write a lengthier piece to find out what happened, to talk to a lot of people. I mean, right, Victoria? I think about Kalief, yeah, Browder and all of the attention in The New Yorker. How many other Kalief Browders are out there that we've never heard about?
Yes, yes, indeed. And there are so many, because anytime you talk to anyone who does public defense work in New York City, in other large metropolitan areas, they'll tell you, you know, they have clients that have been sitting on Rikers Island for months, if not years on end, for, you know, awaiting their day in court. Mm. They haven't been convicted of anything, and they're being subjected to these kinds of conditions. Around the same time that Kalief Browder was sitting at Rikers, there's also a woman called, a young woman named Candy Haley Means, who had been arrested and accused of having a fight and stabbing a baby during that fight. So allegedly, she got in a fight with another person, and somehow a baby ended up injured. And this is a pretty horrific charge. So, you know, most people are thinking, like, you know, well, I don't want to get involved in this. I don't want to report on this. This is not a sympathetic charge. She spent 3 years at Rikers Island, where she was sexually assaulted by jail staff. She tried to kill herself numerous times. She was placed in solitary confinement. Solitary confinement, which, as many of your listeners may know, is when you are locked into a cell 23 and a half hours each day by yourself. You don't get any human contact when you are brought out of your cell. You often are done so in handcuffs and shackles. You don't have any human contact other than the guards that slip your food tray through a slot for meals. And being in solitary confinement exacerbated her mental health issues, or wrecked her mental health, I'm not sure which, and she began cutting herself. And every time she was caught cutting herself, she was issued another ticket, which prolonged her stay in solitary confinement. And finally, 3 years after she had been arrested and charged with what seems to be a very horrific crime, she went to trial and she was fully acquitted. The whole time she had said, I did not stab this baby. I am not responsible for this harm done to this baby. Like, I was not the one that hurt this baby. And it took 3 years for her to get her day in court and to be acquitted. Again, this is, you know, on the face of it, it seems like a horrific charge. Who goes around hurting babies? And people might be less sympathetic than to a kid accused of stealing a backpack. Mm. But in the end, 3 years of her life were also stolen, and she was ultimately acquitted. But she had been sexually assaulted, her mental health had been wrecked, she had tried to commit suicide several times after that, and even after getting out of jail, you know, her mental health swerved. She'd lost her job, she'd lost her housing during that time, and she had to rebuild her life with all of this other baggage.
Wow. Maurice, I mean, everyone has a story. At the Marshall Project, how do you all decide which story to really tell in an in-depth manner?
I was a little worried that was your next question. And it's a very hard one to answer because it's such a subjective process in a way. I mean, you're as a writer, you're a human being. And on the one hand, you're trying to kind of chronicle the larger system and find stories that illuminate the dynamics in a way. You know, I mean, if there's some law that's up for debate or some legal issue that's in the courts and there's a case that kind of exemplifies that in some way, often, you know, we'll pick to kind of go in depth on a case because of the way that it exemplifies larger dynamics that apply to lots of different cases. But that said, also sometimes a case just draws you in and there's really no, there's, you know, no simple or obvious explanation for why it does that. So one story that comes to mind that I worked on that came out about a year ago was about a family in which basically this 5-year-old kid and her 10-year-old brother accused their father of sexual molestation, and he was convicted and went to prison for 20 years for this. And it turned out that he didn't actually do anything to them, and their memories and their sort of their memories were kind of manipulated by overzealous investigators who were just convinced that this man was guilty and got the kids to say it. And you know how kids can be, they can be sort of easily manipulated. And the story, there have been many stories about people who were wrongfully convicted. That's not a sort of new idea. Mm-hmm. What was new to me in this one case was the fact that you had these two kids who grew up knowing their father was in prison, knowing that they had been in a way connected to him being there, but not quite understanding all the details or getting it. And then as they become older and become adults, they start to kind of ponder, well, why is Dad in prison? They say he did these things to us, but I don't remember that. And then as they become adults, he gets out of prison and they reconnect with him. And there's a sort of a lot of healing that has to happen, a lot of reckoning about the way in which this family had been kind of pulled apart. And that, you know, there are larger trends and dynamics that that illustrates, you know, the issues around children as witnesses, the way overzealous investigators can create a conviction where the person didn't actually commit the crime. But also it was just a unique story in which I had found this young woman who could speak in a really clear way about growing up with this sort of thing hanging over her, and it just, you know, drew me in, and it just seemed like a really compelling story that could sort of teach people from about the criminal justice system by exposing them to a human story that was really captivating. Mm.
Maurice Chamas is a staff writer with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. Victoria Law is a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration. And we have a caller who's been waiting patiently. I want to go to Ariana in San Francisco. Hi, Ariana. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate that. I have a number of comments because I did my academic research on prisoner reentry and the massive incarceration of indigenous people of color. And I want to say that Google has censored every link to my dissertation since it was published in 2009. And so the media does control thought, and people think that Google is just involved in shopping concerns. I also want to say that with the media that, for instance, the New York Times pairs pictures. For instance, we'll have a picture of a movie with a black man pointing a gun towards the reader, and next to it they'll have a woman modeling a mink coat. So there's a lot of unconscious and deliberate modeling of what people's beliefs are. I believe that this whole subject matter revolves around divide and conquer politics and white supremacy. And this is a certain kind of racism when we think of people who have had power in this country who are predominantly white and men, not all, but who think that their needs and values and beliefs are much more civilized and superior than others. And it's just not the case. People have needs and wants that are the same, and when they're denied basic needs, they live lives of desperation, and it's relentless. It leads often to drug addiction or mental illness. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I want to talk about the psychological problems that originate in the founding fathers, quote-unquote. That's not really true, but the founding people who brought Calvinism to this country. And the Calvinists believed that those who were chosen by God would be known by their goods, meaning their beauty, their wealth, their power. This kind of belief system reinforces the superiority of people who have power in the status quo. Mm. And the second thing that
Ariana, so sorry to cut you off, but we have just a couple of minutes left, and I just want to ask you a question about what Ariana said. I mean, the numbers are out there. We know that the majority of people in prison are Black, Latino, and when you look at also Native American, that doesn't get talked about as much, especially when you look at drug rates and things like that. How do you cover that part of it? Because it's getting more attention. And Maurice, as you said earlier, there's so much more awareness raising around these issues. Opinions about all of this are really changing. Do you think that that's entering the coverage? And how is it entering the coverage?
That's a good question. I think that it is. I mean, like Victoria has said, I mean, you're seeing, you know, more coverage of groups that are fighting back. So, for example, that story published in The Appeal about New Orleans, or, you know, I'm seeing all the time coverage of criminal justice issues that put the people who are affected by them kind of front and center, as opposed to the policymakers being front and center, or the politicians who are campaigning on, you know, criminal justice. You're actually seeing more and more stories about just sort of regular people who a reader can identify with, who in one way or another were pulled into the criminal justice system because of an issue of poverty or addiction, or because they just made a really bad decision one day, I feel like I'm seeing, you know, more and more stories where the sort of front and center, the first sentence in the article is meet so and so. This is what their life was like, and there are policies that are affecting their life in this way and that way. Mm. But the center of attention is the person. I think I'm seeing more of that than I used to, but you know, I'm a data point of one.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely true, and we're also seeing major investigations. I mean, you both have written extensively, and I just want to quickly ask you, Victoria. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. You have a lengthy piece, "Corporations Are Profiting from Immigrant Detainees' Labor. Some say it's slavery. At privately run detention centers, immigrants say they're forced to work for $1 a day, and in some cases, if they need toilet paper or sanitary napkins, they will not get them unless
they work for a dollar a day. This was a lengthy story. Can you just give us a synopsis of this, and specifically the role that these privately run detention centers play in all of this?
Yes. So privately run detention centers hold I think the majority of people in immigrant detention these days, and many of them participate in what's known as or misnamed as the Voluntary Work Program, which is an ICE program which supposedly allows people who are in detention to work for up to 8 hours a day and be paid a dollar a day, which is a wage that was set in the late 1970s and has not been revisited since then. And a number of people who were detained or even are currently detained at five different privately run immigrant detention centers have filed lawsuits against private prison company CoreCivic and private prison company Geo Group, alleging that these quote-unquote voluntary work programs actually are not voluntary, and they have been forced to participate in these programs under the threat of not just not getting very needed things like toilet paper, sanitary napkins, you know, a decent amount of food, but also being threatened with being placed in more dangerous housing conditions or solitary confinement if they refuse to work in these programs. So across the country, there have been five lawsuits filed, again, by people who have been impacted, and in the case of the most recent one, filed against CoreCivic by two people who are still currently in CoreCivic's detention center and thus probably are subject to all sorts of retaliation with very little recourse. But they're standing up and they're saying no, and they're accusing these corporations of trafficking and violating the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which states that you cannot force somebody to labor under forced threat or coercion, forced fraud or coercion. And that's what they're saying these companies are doing. Mm. And it's a different form of trafficking than what we usually think of.
And you write that since the election, CoreCivic stock has gone up a whopping 81%. Geo Group's
yes.
has risen 63%. In 2017, 24% of Geo Group's $2.2 billion revenue came just from ICE contracts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, we'd love to have you back to talk specifically about that. Victoria Law is a freelance. I would love to have you back. Victoria Law is a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration. Be sure to read her lengthy piece at In These Times called Corporations Are Profiting from Immigrant Detainees' Labor. Victoria is the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. Victoria, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Maurice Chamat is a staff writer at the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Be sure to head over to Your Call Radio to find all of his pieces. One that really stood out for us, 7 years behind bars for two joints, and now he's free. Bernard Noble, whose case became a symbol of harsh drug laws, walks out of a Louisiana prison. This happened just last month. Maurice, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.